Good morning, sir. I believe you're Mr. Miles. Am I correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
If you would hold on for just one moment, the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson will serve as a lead for the hearing, and he will begin very shortly. So just hold on to the phone, sir.
I will.
Thank you.
Good morning, sir. How are you this morning? Mr. Miles?
Mr. Miles, can you hear Honorable Mr. Johnson?
No.
Can you hear me now, sir?
You still cannot hear him, sir?
I can hear him, but I can't really make out what he's saying.
How's this?
Computer.
It is your back. Can you hear me, sir?
You still cannot hear him, sir?
Not very well.
Mr. Miles?
Yes.
Let me get you to hold on for a moment. Let me see if we can get something going a little better here. Just hold on. Don't hang up on me.
I won't.
Okay.
I'll be able to hear him as clear as possible.
We're still having some problems with our technology, and we're getting some feedback from our second computer over here. And when Ms. Renee could come in and see if she can figure out what's going on, or someone can help us to get on track this morning.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
I'm just trying to get some help for Mr. Miles so that you can hear us and we can hear you. Well, we can hear you just fine, but you cannot hear us. You can only hear me. Am I correct? So you can hear me quite well.
Yes, I can hear you clearly.
Okay, let me check some others. Let me see if we can hear you, Mr. Neal.
Can you hear me all right, sir? Wow.
Can you hear that gentleman?
Mr. Miles?
No.
Mr. Honorable Mr. Torrens?
Mr. Miles, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, so we can hear you. You can hear me.
Okay, sir, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm listening right now.
Mr. Miles, can you hear me?
Yeah, it's like some feedback.
And we'll get some feedback too from this.
We'll have some feedback too,
Bob. We'll get some feedback from that one over there. Just hold on, Mr. Miles. We're working on it.
Okay, thank you.
Well, so you still getting feedback, sir?
No.
You're not getting feedback now. Okay, let me check with Honorable Mr. Johnson, see what happens.
Mr. Miles, can you hear me, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I think we're ready to go now, so just hold on, and the Honorable Mr. Johnson will now meet your hearing, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Miles, could you please state your full name and your ADC number for us for the record, please?
098955.
And could you please state your full name for us?
Kevin Ortiz Miles.
Okay, so you're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. I'm going to introduce you to the board members that are conducting your hearing today. Although you can't see us, we have the Honorable Luis Quinones, the Honorable David Miller, the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, who's our board chair, the Honorable Mrs. Gail Rittenhouse, and my name is Michael Johnson, so I'm going to be acting as your panel lead this morning, okay?
Okay.
You say, I'm going to go through some information with you. Before I get started, there are people here that are going to be speaking. I just want to make sure that I'm clear. Who I have signed in is Karen Robbins. For Thomas Friedman, I'm sorry. Okay. Heather Berry. Martha, gotta help me with this last name, Paycom. Mr. Tim Gabrielson.
Yes, sir, I'm Mr. Miles' attorney.
Okay, you wanna come up, sir? We have the county attorney that's here.
Yes, Rebecca.
Yes, sir, you wanna come up?
I'll sit up with the family if you don't mind, sir.
Okay, that's fine. Is there anyone else that's gonna be speaking that's here in this case today? On the victim witness side? Okay. So, Mr. Miles?
Yes.
We do have your attorney here, so I am going to go through some information, sir, then I'm going to give you and your attorney the opportunity to speak at that time after I finish going through some basic information, okay?
Okay.
All right. So you are appearing before this board for an absolute discharge or parole to your next consecutive sentence. Is that your understanding, Mr. Miles?
Yes, sir.
Okay. According to the information that we have from Tom Comp and the Department of Corrections, that you should have had a hearing back in October of 2016. However, it didn't come up, and they've asked that if deemed necessary, that if you parole to your next consecutive sentence, that it becomes effective October 16th. Are you aware of that, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So you are currently serving a life sentence, 25 years to life sentence, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And if you parole to your next consecutive sentence, you would go to a 35-year sentence for a kidnapping, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You also had another 35-year sentence for armed robbery, but that sentence ran concurrent with your life sentence. Is that with the life sentence, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You were...
Mr. Johnson, may I interrupt, please?
Yes, sir.
He got sentenced originally to death in 2015. The Superior Court of Pima County granted post-conviction relief, gave him a sentence of life in prison with the possibility of parole after 25, which is what we're here for. The armed robbery and the kidnapping sentences were both 35 years. They run concurrent to each other and consecutive to the murder sentence. And with the chair's permission, I've got the sentencing hearing transcript from 1993. If the board needs any clarification at all as to what Judge Tenney sentenced Mr. Miles.
Do you have an extra one? Because if you give it to us, then we can't return it to you.
No, that's okay. I've got okay. Can I approach the chair?
Yes, sir. Please do.
So,
thank you, sir.
Yeah. So what I'm showing on here is that he had, and I was going to go through because he's had several hearings to get to where he's at now. I mean, appeals to get to where he's at now.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So he had, according to the documentation that we have, that he has a 35-year sentence that was consecutive to CO2. And then, which was the armed robbery sentence was running concurrent at the time. So that's the only difference. You're saying that they both were consecutive.
I'm saying, yes, you're exactly right, Mr. Johnson. Judge Tenney, on this transcript, you'll see that he sentenced him to at that time, he gave him the death penalty. And as you suggested, there are a number of appeals that have happened since then. Eventually, Judge Villarreal, a Superior Court judge in Tucson, granted post-conviction relief, gave him life, vacated the death sentence, gave him life with the possibility of parole after 25 years. That 25 years occurred on July 6th of this year. This board originally scheduled him for a parole hearing just within a week or so of that date. Because of how fresh the legal proceedings were still in the Arizona Supreme Court, I contacted Ms. Mills, who does great work for all of you, and I think she approached Dr. Wright and was able to get this hearing moved to September. But again, the sentences for armed robbery and kidnapping, Judge Tinney said they run concurrent to each other and consecutive, both of them consecutive to, at that time, the death penalty, which obviously when the death penalty was vacated, those sentences would then run, those would be consecutive to his finishing a life term, or if this, at some point if this honorable board sees fit to grant him parole, those 35s will start running from the date the parole is granted. I should point out, too, Mr. Miles turned 50 years old this past spring, and even a grant of parole, while not illusory, I mean, it's he's not looking to be eligible for parole again until he's in his early 70s.
Okay, so I'm going to continue to go through some of this information.
Yes, sir.
There is like just a difference in the documentation that we have, which really doesn't make a big difference because it's the 35-year sentence that he has after the life, after this sentence. That
Mr.
He
Johnson, you and I come out to the same point on this. We noticed the same problem in the documentation that the Department of Corrections has, where one of the outdates appears to be the year 2063, and that simply is incorrect, and that's why I brought the transcript of the sentencing hearing, because I think the Department of Corrections made a typographical error of some kind. I don't blame them for anything. I'm just saying I think that somebody miscalculated or misread the sentencing hearing transcript when they stated what that outdate would be. And I provided for the board the Department of Corrections records that would be in Appendix C of the documentation that we provided. There's an incorrect outdate of 2063, but again, it's based on a miscalculation of when one of those sentences starts running. I think we're in agreement, though, Mr. Johnson. I think that we're here to determine if the board believes Mr. Miles should be paroled to those two consecutive sentences for armed robbery and kidnapping.
Okay.
We agree with you that if that's your understanding of the proceeding, we are in. We concur with that.
Okay. So I'm going to go over the institutional progress report with you, Mr. Miles, and sir, certainly if there's something that you don't want him to answer, then you certainly have that right, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so Mr. Miles, my understanding in looking at your institution progress report that we have from the Department of Corrections is that over the last 2 years, looks like you have taken quite a bit of programming, sir. Mr. Miles?
I didn't hear you on that. It sounds like some papers were rustling in the background, so I was having problems hearing that question.
Okay, so sir, I'm looking at your institutional progress report from the Department of Corrections, and it looks like over the last 2 years, you've taken quite a bit of programming since 2016. Is that about right?
2015? 16,
sir. 2016.
Well, there hasn't been that many opportunities to participate in programs from death row inmates. They wouldn't allow us to participate in the institutional programs until 2014. So from 93 to 2014, I was pretty much just confined to my cell 23 to 24 hours a day without being allowed by DOC policy to participate in any of these educational programs or rehabilitating programs. So,
Mr. Johnson, I might be able to shed some light on this. Only to state to the board that the board may be aware that in 2017, our death row clients started being moved from the Browning unit, where, as Kevin said, they were on 23-hour lockdown every day, to the central unit with more privileges, with more open cells, with more availability of programs, more opportunities to work as porters or, to clean showers, to clean the unit, and Kevin has taken advantage of those opportunities. On May 11th of this year, after his death sentence was overturned, after the Arizona Supreme Court affirmed Judge Villarreal's order, Kevin was moved to the writing unit with additional freedoms to participate in programs and porter opportunities. He was a shower porter. He's now a unit porter on his tier. And so I'm not aware of documentation that shows that classes or anything of that sort have been made available to him, but I believe he has been promoted within the Porter system. He's applied for what the inmates view to be better jobs, and he's received those. He's gotten good marks from the administrators in his unit, the correctional officers and such. And so I don't know about I don't have any documentation for classes or programs, but I know that he's taken advantage of work opportunity.
I attended classes every Tuesday at Central Unit, yet before we were able to get the certificate, I was moved off from death row and then moved over here to this unit before we were able to get the certificate of completion. But we would have classes every Tuesday around 9:30 to 10:30 on issues like self-control. I also applied to be in the Alcoholics Anonymous class at Central Unit, but they kept death row inmates separate from the rest of the population, so they never were able to get those classes set before I was off from death row. Now that I'm here at Rining Unit, I've applied to be applied to be added to the AA classes, and I'm still on the waiting list. And I checked about 2 weeks ago when they told me about this hearing, I checked on the status, and they said I was still number 32 on the list. So I'm trying to be included in the AA classes and the NA classes, but the waiting lists are just so long, I haven't had a chance to, to be in included in the classes.
Okay, Mr. Miles, what I was trying to get at is that it looks like you have, according to the Institutional Progress Report, that in 2016 you were involved in several programs with values and personality, anger management, did the 12-step program, you had a socializing program in 16, substance abuse program in 16. Then in 17, looks like you did a relapse class, you had one on attitudes in 17, and then in 2018, you did a cultural diversity class. I was just trying to get to those last few years that you were incarcerated, that you have been involved in some programs since 2016. Do you recall those programs, sir? I understand about what happened during the period of time that you went on death row.
Oh, yes, I recall those programs.
Okay, well, that's what I was trying to get around to. I also said, I understand, according to the release plan, that you says that you want to go stay and live with a good friend of yours in Seattle, Washington, if you were released.
Yes.
And that you have a substantial amount of money in your bank account.
Excuse me?
That you have a substantial amount of money in your bank account.
Do I?
Well, that's what it says in your progress report. It says that you have a substantial amount of money in your bank account.
Yes, I do.
Okay. And you haven't had any disciplinary actions since, looks like June 22nd of 2000, but you have been on death row for the majority of the time that you've been incarcerated. Is that right, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So according to the documentation that I have, it looks like you were on death row until May or April 4th of 2018, from 1993 to 2018, you were on death row, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Also, I'm going to go back just a little bit before I get into talking about the incident that actually occurred. At the time that the incident occurred, you were 23 years old, sir?
24
years old?
Yes, sir.
And there were two juveniles involved, were both of them 16 years old?
16, 17.
Okay. And this is your first parole hearing that you actually have, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and that you You don't have any warrants or detainers. So I'm going to go over what we have in the pre-sentence report on what happened when this incident actually occurred. And then I'm going to give you an opportunity, as well as your attorney, an opportunity to respond to this, okay?
Okay.
It says that at approximately 1:30 p.m. on December 7, 1992, you along with two juvenile companions waited for a car to stop near the area of 24th Street and Columbus Avenue in Tucson. And then it says within, when the 40-year-old female victim approached in her vehicle and stopped, that the defendant and or the juvenile asked for a light or a cigarette. She reached for the cigarette lighter in the car, and the defendant and one of the juveniles pointed the .45 caliber handgun at her head and told her to move over, at which time she did. The defendant and the juvenile took control of the car, kept the gun pointed at her head, it doesn't say who actually did it in here, and drove to the desert area where she was shot once in the chest. The bullet passed through her left arm before entering into a chest. She died from this gunshot wound, which lacerated her heart and left lungs. The defendant and the juveniles departed in a car. It says that later on in the evening, that same day that you drove the victim's car to Chandler and Tempe, then on December 9th at about 3 a.m. in the morning, Chandler police attempted to pull over you for speeding 60 miles per hour in a 35 per hour zone. Says the high-speed chase ended when the car was crashed. A record check revealed that the car was stolen. Says that police found the victim's checkbook, a credit card, and bank card, a ring, and earrings. Additional jewelry, a watch, and bracelets were recovered later. Said that you admitted to using the bank card in Tucson, and that you also implicated the juveniles in there. Is that about right, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So what I'm going to do, Mr.
Johnson, I need to ask just for clarification. If I disagree with something, and in my statement I file, I did disagree with portions of the pre-sentence.
You did.
Report.
I did.
If the board wants me to interrupt you at the points when I think there needs to be the kind of clarification I supplied in the statement, I would be happy to do that. As I said, the pre-sentence report, the writer, the author of the pre-sentence report was a probation officer, not subject to cross-examination. It's not clear what the sources were, the sources of information came from. Some of it was from the co-defendants after they were arrested. But there are some discrepancies there with regard to whether Kevin Miles asked Mrs. Bauerlin for a light. That was Levi Jackson. Kevin Miles didn't do that. Ian Ray Hernandez was standing off to the side. More importantly, the unfortunate statement about Kevin at some point holding the gun on the victim, that absolutely did not happen. And in front of Judge Villarreal, we pointed out, we gave Judge Villarreal the police reports of the interviews with Levi Jackson and Kevin Miles. I think Ray Hernandez, I believe, did not make a statement to police. No, I'm sorry. Ray Hernandez spoke to police. Levi did not. So Kevin and Ray did. At no time did either of them indicate to police that Kevin held the gun on the victim. At most, Kevin took the gun from one of the co-defendants and handed it to another. The statement that Kevin held the gun on the victim, the only time, the first time that that was cited was the Arizona Supreme Court made that finding without attribution to any of the witnesses in the case. And after that, the prosecution at trial and then their initial briefing in this case never made an assertion that Kevin was that culpable that he held the gun on the victim. The Arizona Supreme Court placed that fact into its opinion. And we asked Judge Villarreal to reject it. It's not being supported by record evidence. He said he could not reject a fact finding made by the Arizona Supreme Court. In my statement, I indicate if we were proceeding in federal court and wanted to contest that statement, there is a provision in the federal habeas corpus statute that allows us to attack facts that are unreasonably determined because they're contrary to the record evidence in the case. So we pointed that out to Judge Villarreal. He said he was powerless to, and that's in his the first written order he made disclosing of some of the claims in the case. He said he was powerless to undermine a fact-finding made by the Arizona Supreme Court. But I just can't state, you know, strongly enough that, and I cite to the record portions in the statement I submitted to this court, I cited to the portions of the record that were in front of Judge Villarreal that dispute that fact that Kevin held a gun on the victim.
Okay. So this is what I'm going to do, because I don't want to go back and forth with you. I want to go through systematically what had occurred. And in the end, the reason that he was given the 25 years to life after all that, I mean, there's several appeals that went through this and different courts, but
and were unsuccessful.
And so in the end, the basic reason that I'm understanding, and I'm gonna, you know, go through it with you, is that the court basically ruled that he wasn't the one who actually pulled the trigger, shot the female, shot the victim, and that there couldn't be, because you have felony murder, that they felt that may have been a little bit excessive. You couldn't give him the death penalty, basically, for not being the one who actually was the one who did the shooting. I'm going to ask you to sum that up, because there's a lot of hearings that were unsuccessful, right, that went through. So I'm just trying to get to, basically, that's how he got to the 25 years to life sentence. That's kind of where that was overturned. But before I get to that, I'll let you respond and go through the chronological order of what you want to go through, all the documentation that you have and the paperwork that you actually, file that you've actually given us. But I do want to know if from Mr. Miles, I do want to know from Mr. Miles what occurred in his mind, what was going on, and what was going on during that period of time in his mind, and how he has changed from the time that incident happened to the time now. And then I want to go into the appeals that he actually had, because he did have several appeals that were unsuccessful, and he did finally have a one, and you know, you can explain that. I'm just giving my opinion, which is a layman's opinion, of reading all the documentation that we have of why basically his death sentence was overturned and he was given the 25 years to life sentence, okay?
Yes, sir.
So would that be permissible for you, if I have Mr. Miles, go ahead and explain that, or would you rather for him not to do that?
No, I would rather he go ahead and explain it. He's a very eloquent person and speaks with great sincerity about this. I would like you to ask him whatever you want to ask him about what happened that day.
Okay, so Mr. Miles, I'm going through what we have in the pre-sentence report, pretty basic of what we've gone through in this situation. But I would like, sir, for you, Mr. Miles, to tell this board, you know, what occurred during that period of time and how you came about being involved in this situation along with the other two defendants.
Okay. Yes, sir. No, I will do that. Many weeks, 2 to 3 weeks before this crime took place, I was in a bad spot, a bad place mentally. I had just recently separated from my wife about a month and a half, my mom died, and I couldn't cope with that in the correct way. I was self-medicating, drinking, smoking marijuana, smoking crack cocaine every day. So the night before this crime, I had been up smoking crack, drinking. I had a motel room. Levi Jackson was not a close friend of mine. He was a friend of a friend. I had a motel room. I was coming down off of a bender, and he just showed up at the motel room. I didn't have a place to stay at the motel. We had hired the motel, and I was getting ready to get kicked out of that motel. So he comes over. He wants to hang out. And I say, we can't hang out here because I don't have the money to pay for this motel room. So he comes up with the idea to jack somebody or carjack somebody. I, being older, now, hindsight being 2020, I realized that I was older than him and I should have had more influence over him. At the time, my focus was getting money for drugs, getting money to get high. I wasn't thinking about myself. I wasn't thinking about him. I wasn't thinking about anything else other than using crack cocaine. So we leave the motel room. We head to a supermarket that was two blocks down the street, and Mr. Jackson see one of his friends, someone I never met before, haven't seen since the crime, and he suggested that we go to one of his friend's house and take a gun. So we walk to this friend's house. I don't go inside the apartment. I don't go inside the house. I don't go into the driveway. I'm standing in front of the house on the street while Mr. Jackson and Mr. Hernandez go into this home, and they know where the gun is, and they come out with the gun. I don't try to take the gun away from Mr. Jackson. I don't try to woo them away from this situation. I'm just going along for the ride, not being responsible. I take full responsibility of that, because what I've learned over the years is that what I've had to accept is that even though I wasn't promoting this crime, or even though I wasn't trying to tell them what to do, the fact that I was older than them, or the fact that I am older than them, in their mind, they were going to try to impress me just because I was older and they thought I was cool. It took me many years to accept that, and I fully accept that. But I didn't tell them to do this. I didn't know anything about this gun, but I didn't try to stop it. I fully admit I didn't try to stop it. We continue after they go into the house and steal the gun. We continue down the street. And that's when we see the victim. She's in her car. She stops at a stoplight. Mr. Hernandez and I, we stay in back. Mr. Jackson, he walks up to the victim, asks her for a light, for the cigarette. As soon as she reaches for her car lighter, Mr. Jackson puts the gun in her face, asks her to scoot over, looks back at us, and tells us to come on. And Mr. Hernandez and I, we jump in the back of the car. At this time, I fully admit that I was just like, it was a laser beam focus going through the victim's personal belongings as far as her pocketbook and her purse, trying to get some money. And that was all my focus was. As my lawyer mentioned earlier, the only time I held the gun was when Mr. Jackson was driving the car. He passed the gun back to me. I grabbed it and then immediately gave it to Mr. Hernandez. That was the only time that I ever touched that gun. Which I should have tried to stop it, but my focus was on getting money for crack cocaine, and I couldn't focus on anything other than that. When we get out to the middle of the field or the desert, once again, Mr. Jackson escorts the victim out the car, and me and Mr. Hernandez, we jump in the front seat of the car. I actually jump into the driver's seat of the car. We drive away. Well, we drive out. Mr. Jackson is still out there in the field. Mr. Hernandez and I, we drive the car toward getting out of the field. Mr. Jackson runs towards the car, and he turns around and fires a gun that kills the victim, and he jumps in the car, and me and Mr. Hernandez were shocked. Mr. Hernandez was almost in tears. I couldn't believe what was going on, but at the same time, my focus on just getting money had actually been completed. I had some money now. So it was, from my perspective, it was just a blur. You know, the victim was shot. She fell to the ground. There was a lot of yelling in the car. Levi had the gun. We didn't want to yell too much because we didn't know what he would do next. And even though I was older than them, I still felt like I was just another kid at that moment. But at the same time, I had money in my pocket now, so I was just focused on going to the drug house and buying some more crack. And that's what we did. We left. We got money. Mr. Hernandez didn't receive any of the money. I gave Levi just a little bit of the money, and I took the rest of the money and started smoking crack again. And that's pretty much, I mean, I can answer any other questions you have. I just, you know, I really don't know how to explain other than, you know, I was just, I'm not a sociopath or a psychopath. I was just focused on getting money so I could get my next fix of cocaine, crack cocaine. It was a senseless, every day is a constant reminder of how I let myself get involved with such a senseless act from a person who the victim's family has always been supportive. They've been at every hearing, they've been at every even small hearing, they've been there. They were at my hearing in October of 2015, so that's always been a constant reminder of the woman who I had a responsibility of taking her life. And it's a little senseless. I'm ashamed of it. And I have to spend every day for the rest of my life being punished for that. And rightfully so. You know, it was a senseless act. It was uncalled for. We didn't have to even get in her car. She would have given up her purse. Even if that's what we had to do. I mean, obviously, the thing to have done would have been not to commit a crime. The thing to have done would to work hard, get a 9-to-5 job, or even work day labor to get our own money and earn our own things. But as far as the crime itself, we could have just asked for a purse and just left. If we had to commit the crime, I know, like I said, we didn't have to do that in the first place. So it's really hard to talk about because it's just so shameful. It's just not who I am. It's just not who I was before that. I can't really continue to try to make excuses, but I can explain that my brain was focused on nothing but crack cocaine at that time, as it had been since, I'd say, September of 1992 up until the time I was arrested. My brain was focused on smoking crack, as much crack as I could every day. And that's what led me to be into this situation that I'm in now.
Okay, Mr. Miles, let me see if the board has any questions for you. So no questions coming from the board. I'm going to ask the attorney just because we've been talking. I should have had you come up to the mic, so I'm sorry. If you would just come up to the mic and just state your full name. And then what I want to do is if you could just kind of explain to this board kind of in layman terms, because of how he had his life sentence, his death sentence commuted to a life sentence. And I think, like I was saying earlier, part of it was that it was a felony murder, but that the death penalty could only apply if he himself killed, attempted to kill, or intended that the killing occur with lethal force, or was a major participant in a felony and acted with reckless indifference of human life. But it also says that his diminished capacity could also be considered, and I think from what I read and understand that there's, after several appeals, the diminished capacity had to do with him being on drugs and things that was going on in his life at that time. So if you can kind of explain that to the board in layman terms, that I've read all these documents, so and just state your full name for
the record. Yes, Mr. Johnson, my name is Timothy Gabrielson, Gabrielsen. I'm an assistant federal public defender in Tucson. I have represented Kevin since the spring of 2012 when a prior counsel dumped Kevin's case on us after he had argued the case in the Ninth Circuit and wanted to leave the case with us. And I'm happy, Mr. Johnson, to explain the, and I can boil this down fairly quickly. The premise that you stated that Kevin's death sentence was vacated because he was only convicted of felony murder, that one convicted of murder is guilty by accountability is a mitigating factor in the death penalty hearing, or can be. It is not a basis under Arizona law to vacate the death sentence. Judge Villarreal did not vacate the death sentence in this case because Kevin was guilty by accountability. Judge Villarreal vacated the death sentence in this case because evidence that had never been presented in any court in the 20-year history of this case, Kevin's social history going back to his childhood, in fact, before childhood, his biological mother was an alcoholic and a prostitute in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She was drinking while Kevin was in utero. We know now that Kevin suffered from what's called an alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder that caused him right from birth to have deficits in cognitive functioning, behavioral functioning, emotional functioning, and it went untreated, which is critical, according to all the doctors who testified in the hearing in front of Judge Villarreal. Said it was critical that Kevin's AR, they call it ARND, it went untreated. It caused him to suffer anxiety. It caused him to not be able to, two of the doctors said he couldn't focus on the big picture. He couldn't process information, especially when he was under stress. And I would submit that, you know, the incident that we're talking about, this tragic, as Kevin said, senseless loss of Ms. Garland's life, was one of those stressful circumstances. As Kevin said, and he was eloquent, he talked about how he spiraled into depression and started self-medicating when both his wife and daughter left, and his mother, his biological mother, passed away. He started committing property crimes and committed several armed robberies to get money to support his crack habit. No one was ever injured in any of those incidents. The pre-sentence report writer indicated that Kevin even telephoned the first victim at the retail shop where she worked to report that he was the one who committed the armed robbery in the store, gave her his name. That was relayed to the police. Unfortunately, they did not find him or catch him. He didn't turn himself in, but they didn't find him or catch him until after Ms. Farland's death. So he starts life with an alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder in the fall, and I'm going to ask one of his very good friends who testified in front of Judge Villarreal, Marcy Pekka, is going to testify that she knew Kevin when she was a college student in Tucson, and she's going to speak to his good character and how he was not addicted to drugs in the spring or summer of 1992, was not addicted to crack cocaine. And then Kevin, as he suggested, he spiraled into self-medication of those two losses that he suffered. Part of the ARND is that you don't have good coping mechanisms. If you went untreated, you don't know how to relate to stressful situations in a way where you can extricate yourself with thoughtful, curative, therapeutic measures. And Kevin was operating at this huge deficit when he started down this path of cocaine use. The cocaine use by any of us would cause us to enjoy a euphoria, a high in the pleasure center of the brain that's affected. And the science of that is explained in Judge Villarreal's exhaustive, well-reasoned, well-thought-out order in which he synthesized the testimony of three mental health and medical experts in this case. But it's not the high that Kevin was on that caused him to have the problems on the day of the incident. It was with the withdrawal from cocaine. They're not interchangeable concepts. The euphoria from the high is different from the dysphoria from going through the withdrawal. It's a scourge on our society. These addictions that we're seeing even today, the opioid crisis, methamphetamine, Other drugs may have supplanted crack cocaine as a drug of choice, but these things are still a scourge, and our doctors testified in front of Judge Villarreal that all of these addictions have those same components to them, that when the addict starts going through the withdrawal, the addict is a slave to the drug. And two of our doctors talked about the hijacking of the brain chemistry. This is damage to the brain. This is real organic brain damage that has to do with the cocaine blocking, and this is a medical term, the reuptake of dopamine in the pleasure center of the brain. That's interfered with. So instead of enjoying life when we eat a good meal, when we have sex with our wife, when we enjoy a good movie and we derive pleasure, that's interfered with by the use of the cocaine. The dopamine doesn't go back into the neurotransmitter system. It gets blocked. And so there's, as soon as the cocaine is depleted, there's just a void there. There's no more pleasure in that pleasure center, which causes Kevin and others to go back out and commit more property crimes or robberies to acquire money to get the drug to fill that void where the dopamine hasn't been recycled. So three doctors testified at our hearing, and it was really a pedagogic experience. I mean, Judge Villarreal really listened. He, half the time, as I recall, he had his chin cupped in the palm of his hand with his head turned to the doctors listening. It was a teaching moment, I think, for all of us. I think we all walked away knowing something we didn't know going in. And these doctors were brilliant, not people you would typically associate necessarily with being on the defense side of a capital case. Dr. Pablo Stewart went to the U.S. Naval Academy and then became a Marine Corps infantry officer. And he had eventually, when he got out of the Marine Corps, he went to medical school at the University of California, San Francisco. Eventually, he became the director of the VA Medical Center in San Francisco, and he testified to treating 10,000 veterans addicted to drugs or suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. That's the level of competence he had. Dr. Murray Smith is a psychiatrist. Dr. Murray Smith is a medical doctor, not a psychiatrist, an addiction specialist, who evaluated more than 4,000 drug addicts in his career at Vanderbilt University and later in private practice in Nashville. And these people were spot on in their diagnoses. Mr. Unclesby and his people certainly have the opportunity to bring somebody in to refute or attempt to contradict the testimony of these doctors. And Judge Villarreal makes this point multiple times. The evidence was unrefuted at the hearing how Kevin's brain chemistry was hijacked by the withdrawal from cocaine. So the point Mr. Johnson made about, well, didn't Kevin have his sentence reduced because he was guilty by accountability? In Arizona, that's not a basis for having your sentence reduced or not getting the death penalty in the first place. Arizona is one of a handful of states where you can get the death penalty based on accountability. An accountability theory, if you meet what the U.S. Supreme Court has announced as under the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, we're free from cruel and unusual punishment, right? We all understand that. To get the death penalty, if you're not the shooter, we call them shooters and non-shooters or non-triggermen in the legal parlance. If you're a non-shooter or non-triggerman and the state seeks death against you, they have to prove that you show a reckless disregard for human life. A reckless disregard, it's a subjective view of the defendant's mental functioning at the time of the crime. That's what reckless disregard is under the United States Constitution. Judge Villarreal, while he acknowledged that Kevin didn't kill, he was guilty by accountability, Kevin was still on death row for 22 years before Judge Villarreal said, wait a minute, there's a violation of the Eighth Amendment here because of the alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder and the withdrawal from cocaine. Kevin did not have the subjective ability to, the cognitive functioning to be able to put a stop to what Levi Jackson intended to do. Kevin was powerless to think through other alternatives to what was going on that day. And Mr. Johnson began by asking Kevin what his age was, and Kevin said 24, and the co-defendants were 16 or 17 at the time. And that's true. The doctors testified in front of Judge Villarreal, and this is critical, Judge Villarreal's findings, these are all findings of fact made by the judge. These are not untested hypotheses of defense experts. These are the findings made by the court. Kevin did not have the chronological functioning of a 24-year-old. Two of the medical experts in our case testified that he had the mental functioning of a teenager. So to attribute it, and unfortunately, none of what I've been talking about was presented to the sentencing judge in 1993, and it was never presented. The full picture of Kevin's mental functioning was never presented in any subsequent appeal in this case until he was already out of the Ninth Circuit after his habeas corpus appeals. And our office got the case, and we thought something went terribly wrong there because we've been with Kevin for a period of months, and we can see there's all kinds of deficits in functioning, and no court has ever been apprised of that. So we had Dr. Stewart go in first, Dr. Murray Smith went in second, and finally a neuropsychologist, a brilliant neuropsychologist, Ken Benedict from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, evaluated Kevin. They all came to the same conclusion, alcohol-related neurodevelopment disorder with all of the connotations it carries for cognitive and behavioral inability to function, and then also the cocaine withdrawal. And it's really the ARMD and the cocaine withdrawal that Judge Villarreal really focused on in deciding that Kevin was not eligible for the death penalty because he could not engage in reckless disregard. And the judge made a second finding. In case that finding didn't stand on appeal, he said, you know, in Arizona, we also have the statutory mitigating factor that a defendant cannot conform his conduct to the requirements of law. Kevin Miles, absolutely, because of the hijacking of the brain chemistry from the cocaine withdrawal, could not conform his conduct. He, as Kevin said to the board a few minutes ago, Kevin just went along with the crowd. He was really looking for a fix. He needed money. Dr. Murray Smith testified, a crack addict, when he's going through withdrawal, will often think, if I don't get a fix, I'm going to die. That's how stark it is for the crack addict. And so, Kevin properly talked about how there was a high-speed chase and he was apprehended in Chandler. The first words out of his mouth to the arresting officer was, I need a fix, I need a 20. That's the first thing Kevin said. Nothing exculpatory, no explanation for how he ended up here with the car he had or the accident he caused or any of that. I need a fix. And that's what he said to the police, first thing.
Okay. So, Mr. Gibson, I think we have an understanding. I'm going to see if the glass wanted to get a clear understanding of because you have a lot of court documentations, and I want to get a clear understanding, but I do want to see if the board have any questions of you in reference to this. Mr. Quinones.
Just a quick one, sir. Are you saying, based on everything we've gathered today, that he's developmentally disabled?
That's a mental health term that has particular criteria that must be met to meet that finding of that sort of disability. I don't believe our doctors specifically found that under the DSM as it's defined.
I just wanted to be clear on that because, as you've stated many times, he's very eloquent. He may have some deficit in some category that we're not aware of, but we've read quite a bit of information about what doctors testified to, and I just want to make sure that I understand that. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
I think you have a good handle on that, Mr. Quinones. I think that the point you make about Kevin's eloquent, the death doctors testified that, and this is true of people with mental retardation also, with which this case does not involve, but there's a range of behaviors that mentally damaged individuals can engage in that includes being able to relate socially to people where you can't look at a person with ARND and know instinctively that person suffers from an alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder. That requires very technical testing to develop, and that would be true in the mental retardation area also. It requires testing. You can't look at a mentally retarded or today we call that intellectually disabled person and know that person actually suffers from that disability. But it's a great question and an important question. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Mr. Davidson, I do have a couple questions that I want to ask Mr. Miles. based on what you said. Mr. Miles, are you, have you, when was the last time that you did any drugs, sir?
It's been since 97.
And since you've been able to take classes, how many classes have you taken on substance abuse?
I haven't on substance abuse?
Yes, sir.
I haven't had the opportunity.
Okay.
Since I took a, they used to allow us to participate in Central Arizona Community College up until around 96, 97, and I did enroll and I finished Narcotics Anonymous from Central Arizona Community College, as well as a sociology class that was in 94, 95.
Mm-hmm.
But currently I'm on the waiting list to be enrolled in the AA classes here in this unit.
Okay. So let me ask you a question, sir, because you said in 97, about 97 was the last time that you did any drugs, and you've been on death row since 93, is that right?
Yes, sir.
So for a period of time, you did some drugs when you first went into prison?
Yes. Yes, sir. Yes, I did.
And you've been drug-free since that time. What about for this period of time that you've actually had been off of death row?
I have not done drugs since I've been off of death row, no.
Okay. All right, sir. Mr. Gates, I know you said you had some other witness who wanted to testify.
I have some comments, and then I would like to ask Ms. Pekka to testify or to also answer the board's questions,
okay,
if that's appropriate, sir.
Okay.
I've been with Kevin for 6.5 years as his counsel in federal court, mostly, and obviously for this proceeding. He mentioned earlier that there's not a day that he doesn't think about what he could have done to stop this. I have not had a visit with him in 6.5 years where somewhere in the conversation, he starts looking a little detached, he looks away from me, he starts shaking his head. He said, I can't believe I let those kids do that, that I let Levi shoot them. He says it torments me. And that was going back to the days when he was on death row, when all his appeals had lost. He had no motivation to try to say something that was later going to sway somebody to stop his death sentence. And this is a constant theme with Kevin. And I think you're going to hear from Ms. Pekka in a minute. You're going to hear about Kevin's good qualities before he was addicted to the crack cocaine. And that's, our experts can peg that precisely to the fall of 1992. Also in terms of remorse, it's often said, and I've appeared before this board, not the honorable members assembled here, but in prior boards I've done capital clemency in front of the board. And a question comes up, how come he hasn't stated his remorse for the crime? There's no mechanism under law for an inmate to go to the victim's surviving family members and say, I'm really sorry about what happened. You know, there's actually a statute that bars us from communicating with victims' families unless the prosecution allows that communication to go forward. So it's not like there's some open door where our clients can walk through it. And also, and you'll understand this, that clients are in litigation for the better part of 20 years in these death penalty cases, and it's never appropriate for our clients to be talking to prosecutors or victim survivors about what they did or didn't do. Much of that is still sort of tied up in litigation. But I do want to point out that there was a psychologist who testified at the death penalty hearing in 1993 on March 9th, I'm sorry, on June 21st, 1993, regarding his March 9th, 1993 interview with Kevin. His name is Dr. Martin Levy. And when Dr. Levy testified, Dr. Rubin testified that he thought Kevin had a cocaine problem. Eventually, the prosecution objected. Dr. Rubin could not say that Kevin explained to him when he was last using cocaine before this incident, or what his history of cocaine was. Dr. Rubin never ascertained that, and the lawyers never provided him kind of documentation.
So, Mr. Gabus, we're not trying to retry it. We just want to go over, you know, the basic information that's relating to what we're here for, whether he's paroled to his next consecutive sentence or...
Yes, sir. I'm going both to his character and his behavior in prison. That's really what I'm trying to confine this to. So I just want to point out that any allegation that Kevin has not been remorseful is refuted both by Dr. Levy, who was a guilt phase witness, and also the probation officer who wrote the pre-sentence report says he accepts responsibility. This is in also 1993 before sentencing. He accepts responsibility for his involvement in the kidnapping and armed robbery. Miles didn't want the victim to die. She didn't deserve this. This is all quoted material. The defendant expressed regret regarding the victim's death and loss to her children and family. And I think one other thing that I want to make clear, it hasn't gotten much play, but Kevin served in the United States Navy for 2.5 years of a 4-year enlistment. He got a less than honorable discharge. Why? Alcohol problem. The Navy didn't know he had the ARND. He committed some subordination, never violent crime, but subordination. He went UA, unauthorized absence. And I know from your website, some of the members of this board have served in the military. I appreciate your service, and you'll understand that Kevin tried to live by that military code that everybody lived by. I did for a while when I was in the Marine Corps. Kevin tried to live by it. There was this interference because of this alcohol problem he had that had never been diagnosed or treated. So it gets a little bit glossed over in the course of things. I think Dr. Murray Smith, I think Judge Beery, I'll post Dr. Smith, is talking in very briefly, maybe a sentence in his opinion that Kevin had this problem. And finally, before I ask Ms. Pekka to come up, Kevin has a spiritual side to him that he doesn't talk about very much. And I think it's important, I mean, for those of us that try to live by some code in life or have something that grounds us. And I just wanted to share with the board, maybe enough copies for each person, but in 2016, Kevin said, I want my religious preference to be changed from Christian to Catholic. This is a kind of letter he sent to Chaplain Vicklin at the Browning Unit, to the death row unit. I want my religious preference to be changed from Christian to Catholic. I know that you are extremely busy, so I appreciate your time and assistance with this change of preference in my religion/religious group. Thank you. And on March 15, 2016, Reverend Vicklin says, religious preference changed as requested. As I said, if the chair is, thinks of, I've got copies for the board that I can have to distribute. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. So can I ask you one more question before...
Mr. Miles and myself, sir.
You, yes, sir. Mr. Davidson. Before Ms. Pekka comes up, you've mentioned several times that he had a untreated condition related to the alcoholism and with him and his mom, and the substance abuse with the cocaine, that it was an untreated condition. Yes, my question to you, has that condition ever been treated?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir.
No, sir. But obviously the deprivation of alcohol and cocaine in the prison makes a difference in what Kevin's behavior would be in light of those deficiencies that he suffers from.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And can I ask Ms. Peck that?
Yes, sir, just say, and go ahead and have a seat out there while she comes up.
Thank you.
And please just state your full name and go ahead and present the information to the board.
My full legal name is Martha Carol Pega. I go by Mercy.
Okay. Go ahead and present the information to the board.
And I would probably ask her some questions to get her started, and she can certainly, the board can, you know, ask
her. Okay, here's the issue that I have. If you're going to ask her some questions,
yes, sir.
Then, Sarah, what I'm going to ask you to come back up to the mic and state your name, because these proceedings are being recorded.
Okay.
And so that we can have a clear recording that we actually have, okay? And so...
This is Tim Gabrielson, and I'll be asking Ms. Peka some questions about her relationship with Kevin.
Okay.
Okay. Marcy, how long have you known Kevin?
We met in the early 1992, so it has been 26 years.
And what were the circumstances under which you met Kevin?
I was a college student at University of Arizona and living in an apartment complex there in Tucson, and he also lived in the same apartment complex, and we became friends there.
And where do you reside presently?
Right now I live in Surprise, Arizona.
And what do you do for a living?
I work for State Farm Insurance.
And how long have you worked for State Farm?
This year is my 28-year anniversary of the company.
And did your studies at Arizona prepare you for a career at State Farm?
Well, I took an accounting degree. I majored in accounting, and I started in accounting, and I've just transferred and moved in different positions with the company for now, but yes.
And you said you met Kevin in the early part of 1992. Can you explain what your relationship was with Kevin at that time?
I was a student and living there in the apartment, and it was just friends of the same age in the apartment complex. We met there on the apartment complex grounds. I can't remember exactly the exact meeting time, and there were several of us there that were around the same age, and maybe met at the pool or back and forth to the laundry, and just got talking and became friends with him and his wife at the time.
And they had a baby at the time also?
Yes.
Was your relationship with Kevin ever romantic?
No, sir.
Okay. And when did you graduate from Arizona?
Late May of 1992.
And you had a graduation party?
Yes.
And did your family attend?
Yes, they did.
And did Kevin attend?
Yes, he did.
And did you introduce Kevin to your family?
Yes, he had met I had two brothers living in Tucson at the time. He had met them, I think, even prior to the graduation, and then during the graduation he met my parents and the rest of my family that was there.
And shortly before you graduated, did you learn that Kevin and Tammy had been evicted from their apartment?
Yes, so they were... several weeks before that, I don't remember the exact date, they were evicted, and she had a place for her and Rainey to live, and he didn't. We helped them move and box up their belongings for her, and I don't know if you were going to ask, but that's when he did stay with me in my apartment there. She didn't, I don't remember the exact situation, but the friend that she was staying with was for her and Rainey, and didn't have a place for him, and so he did stay with me in my apartment.
And you had an extra room in your apartment for him?
Well, it was a one-bedroom. The family area had a futon couch, and so that's where he stayed. And
after your graduation, I understand from your 2015 testimony, your life moved fairly quickly. What did you do after graduating?
So the day after I graduated, I think, you know, we were loading my U-Haul. I moved to Bloomington, Illinois to start my job with State Farm Insurance. And so I moved there and was there on my own and alone, and began working there early June.
Mr. Davis, I'm going to interrupt you, because I think Ms. Craver has done some outstanding things in her life, but I don't want to redo the testimony that she may have testified before. I do would like to hear anything that's related to the personality of Mr. Mr. Miles. I want to hear that, but,
yes, sir.
You know, Ms. Fager's life, you know, is not, you know.
No, she's, I introduced some of her biography because she's an outstanding businesswoman of 26 years in the Phoenix community.
And we accept that. We just, okay. You know, well, what I'm saying about
it. We'll talk about Kevin's relationship with her when he came to visit in Bloomington and whether he was, that's where we're going, is whether he was doing.
So is it possible that she could just tell us about what his, you know, what her relationship was, or when he came to visit her.
Yes.
In our own words, because yes, just, because that's what, you know, we would like to hear.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I think part of this is just want to express the Kevin that I knew at that time, the Kevin that I know now, and what our relationship was, and I don't know what the connection was or why we became really good friends really fast there and just developed that connection while there in Tucson before I graduated. And when I moved away, like I said, I was alone in Bloomington, didn't have a lot of friends, and was still speaking with him at that time over the phone. And he knew I was lonely and having a hard time, and actually then came to Bloomington and spent some time there with me and said, I remember him saying, can you make him come out there and make you go out there and meet some people? And he did, and came and spent some time there with me. And probably 3 to 4 weeks there, and we, you know, helped me develop a social life and get comfortable where I was out there. And it was that time while he was there that he found out about his mother being ill, and then left from there to go back to Oklahoma to see her. I can continue just with my story about him.
Let me interject for just a second. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to present to the board members a photograph of Mr. Miles with Ms. Pekka in Bloomington, Illinois during that stay.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Marcy, you've seen this photograph before. That depicts what Kevin looked like back in the day back when he visited you in the summer of 92. I would ask you, you said you would continue. Please tell Mr. Johnson your observations about whether Kevin was using any drugs in your presence in Bloomington.
But no, there were not at that time. There was, I was new to a town and I would not know where to find any, and he was there just visiting and supporting me, so no.
Mr. Turner, he wasn't using any drugs during that period of time, so that's great. In your period of time that you've known him, from the time that he lived there to the time that he came out to visit you, and the relationship, the friendship, I'm going to call it, or the friendship that you had with him, did he ever show any signs of having any mental disabilities from from alcohol or what he went through when he was with his mom or anything from that? It sounds as though he appeared perfectly normal to you during that period of time as a good friend who was there for you, who came to help you.
At that time, there was recreational alcohol. Obviously, when we were in Tucson, I did see some recreational drug use, nothing that I would, obviously not an expert, consider addicted or a constant, anything like that. We were friends, so I thought highly of him. I could have an intelligent conversation and got along and spoke well. At the time when I was with him, there wasn't any of this additional stress yet with his mom, and Tammy left him shortly after that. And when he left is really, I know, when things took a different turn.
And what year was it when he last, when he came?
So that was all in 1992. So it was my final semester, spring of 1992, when I met him, and we were in Tucson, and when I moved in June of 92 to Bloomington, and he spent time there with me in Bloomington, and then, so it was summer of 1992.
Okay, all right. Who's at the board, Mr. Kenyatta?
Just a quick question, ma'am, and this question is not to scrutinize you, but you made reference to recreational drug use. Do you mean smoking marijuana? What do you mean?
Yes, I saw smoking marijuana and smoking crack a couple times.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Well, Mr. Johnson, I just want to know, you know, time management purposes, where are we going with this? I'm getting a little lost.
Yeah, that's kind of...
I just want to know where we're going with it. You know, the board, Mr. Nick, and Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Myatt, we're just trying to make a determination whether he should be moved to his next consecutive sentence, and it just seemed to me that maybe we were not quite getting information. I mean, yes, I think that we recognize the fact that I think everything has been said, and I think that, and I want to commend the attorney for all of this material that he's presented to the board. You just made us do a whole lot of work, a whole lot of reading, sir. But we really appreciate you for presenting it, and I'm just wondering, where is this going to lead us to at the end of this, of your presentation?
I'll say it in a sense or two, Mr. Chairman. The witness is a witness to Kevin's good character and to his law-abiding existence prior to his spiral into cocaine use, which came after he left Bloomington, left Marcy Bloomington, returned to Tucson, and these other events transpired with his mother dying and his wife and child leaving. And so she's a witness to his good character when he was not on crack cocaine. And the point we're trying to, the dots we're trying to connect is that Kevin has been law-abiding for the last 18 years. He's gone without a single ticket in the Department of Corrections, and largely due to his character, which Judge Villarreal saw, and not so much because of the programs that are offered to death row inmates in Arizona, where, frankly, the fellows are housed until the state runs them through the appeals and they can execute them. So it's just a point to make that Kevin was a good guy. He was a law-abiding citizen. He had friends such as a very accomplished businesswoman like Marcy. So we're not bringing in crack addicts from the street to say, oh yeah, Kevin was a good guy. He was functioning in civil society in a very admirable way. That's the purpose of the witness.
Honorable Mr. Johnson, we accept that. I mean, if we're good, I'm not going to speak to you.
I
just agree with that for the board, but if we're good, we're not accept that.
Right, I do too. And this, Marcy, we appreciate you, you know, appearing before. So is there anyone else that you have?
I have to ask Marcy one last thing, and she said something on the phone when I asked her to come down here to testify. I told her, I said, you know, this isn't, he's not getting paroled out to the outside. We're asking that he be paroled to his consecutive sentences. And she made a remarkable statement to me, which I'd like her to repeat to the board, again reflecting on Kevin's character and her relationship with him.
Okay.
Well, I just stated that, you know, I was friends with them, I continue to be friends with them this entire time, and I think very highly of Kevin, and it's hard to say and separate the tragedy that's happened with saying this, but I feel very strongly and highly about him. He would be welcome in my home at any point. And my family feels the same way, just knowing me and my feelings about him and our relationship, and just want to... I think that's what you're referring to.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
That's all I have, Mr. Johnson. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have some other testimony that we're going to hear from the victim witness side. Other than that, there's several people here. I don't know who would like to speak first.
Well, Mr. Johnson, we are requesting the 5 minutes of recess for a break. We're going to 5 minutes recess, and then we'll come back to the victims. Remember that as you go out, the victims must go from this side, must exit from this side. Those who are supportive and others must exit from this side. Thank you. I guess you know that we're on recess. I'm sorry, I didn't say that. We're on recess for about 5 minutes, sir.
Yes, it was really good.
Oh, yeah, all right.
Okay, sir.
And it was a good experience for my wife because it was the last 100-mile road trip. She hasn't been on a bike for about 5 years since she had her surgery. So it's a new bike that we got. And we were able to pull up on the side of the road and load reindeer rod. And we were from the time we left Durango, we left the last time we were in Durango. So it was about, we were like,
Mr. Johnson, I'm going to leave the flying stuff, so why don't we appointed for town management purposes.
Okay, so, Ms. Garrison, is there any particular, I do make note that there is a letter in here from the victim's mother. Were you going to relay, or is there any?
No, I know that the niece is wants to speak.
Okay.
So Heather will be speaking, and she has a letter to read.
Okay, all right.
So at this time, I'm not sure she's thinking about whether she wants to speak, and she'll decide after Heather's done.
Okay, all right. If you would just come up to the podium, just state your full name, and go ahead and present the information to the board.
Okay. My full name is Heather Patricia Berry. And I am the niece of the victim, Patty Bowerland. And I'm going to read my statement. Kevin Miles did nothing to stop the death of my Aunt Patty. As far as I'm concerned, Kevin Miles was a willing participant in a criminal act that caused the death of my Aunt Patty. Kevin Miles should never be given the opportunity to build a life outside of prison walls. He and his family should have to suffer the same pain and anguish that my family has suffered by not being able to have our family member present at all of our life milestones, like weddings, graduations, and other important events. My family has been sentenced to a life living without Patty. The recent commutation of Mr. Miles' death sentence to a life sentence by the Arizona Supreme Court is a serious injustice. That decision has taken away any remaining faith that I had in the criminal justice system. Please do not further erode my faith in the criminal justice system by granting parole to a monster who deserves to die. My family and I will be present here at every parole hearing that occurs for Mr. Miles. We will fight until the day we die to keep him behind bars.
The board has any questions?
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Another family member would like to speak, Mr. Johnson. If you don't mind, if I could stay with you.
Yes, sir.
Excuse me, this is a little bit hard too. I wasn't planning on speaking on that. He was Margo Kamler, and I'm Patty's half sister.
Yeah.
We're grateful for all of your time here, and I wish that we didn't have to be before you today. I'm going to be between you, you know, having mercy in my heart for what's happened and forgetting the justice. And I'm grateful that you're here to judge justice because I wouldn't want to. And I'm a God that I can't possibly change the events that happened or you know, grant peace to these men. I just want peace for our people and love to abound. He said to me by Jackson, you don't have a heart. You don't have a heart to sugar. I wish he didn't have a mean, cruel heart to sugar because he took her from all of us. She worked at ABC Technical Training School. She was a financial aid officer to try to help people who were not able to further their education to become better educated. And this was the injury to aim. He was a drug addict. And all the excuses that as many drug addicts go out of people from happening. He was an adult and he could have stopped this from happening forever. They looked up to him. I'll continue to pray for all the families and people involved in this. Thank you for praying.
The board have any questions? Okay.
I don't believe there are any other family members, Mr. Johnson, by the way. For the record, my name is Rick Huckelstein in the county attorney's office. I was not the original prosecutor on the case, because I'm familiar with Mr. Miles and Mr. Jackson and Mr. Hernandez, who are the defendants in this case. A couple of things I wanted to say first, and that is that there's been much said about Judge Villarreal's findings in the last few years. The board, I would ask that you keep in mind that Judge Villarreal heard some evidence well after 20 years later, 20 years after Mr. Miles was originally sentenced to death. The import of Judge Villarreal's findings were that he found, based on the evidence presented to him, I believe, of 2015, that Mr. Miles was simply not eligible for the death penalty. It did not excuse his criminal behavior in 1992. It did not give him any defense at all to his actions in 1992. Judge Villarreal simply found, based on the evidence that was presented to him 20 years after the original sentencing, that Mr. Miles was not death eligible. And therefore, Judge Villarreal ordered that his sentence be commuted to the only other sentence that was available in 1992, and that was 25 years to life. As I said, it did not give Mr. Miles any defense to his actions on that day. The other thing I want to talk about, Mr. Gabrielson spoke briefly about other offenses committed by Mr. Miles. In the weeks preceding the murder, Mr. Miles committed three separate armed robberies for which he was sentenced by the same judge that gave him the death penalty. These were three separate armed robberies Mr. Miles committed without the presence of Mr. Jackson or Mr. Hernandez. To the extent that the argument is that somehow Mr. Miles was influenced to participate by these two juveniles, I think Mr. Hernandez was 15 at the time, Mr. Jackson, I believe, was 16 at the time. Mr. Miles, of course, had been through the military. He had a wife and family. He was the adult of this group. And to the extent that there's an argument that Mr. Miles was somehow led into this murder by the two juveniles, it's important to remember that Mr. Miles had committed three separate armed robberies prior to the commission of this murder. I'd like to read two very brief passages, if I may. Again, much has been said about Judge Villarreal's finding that Mr. Miles was not death eligible, but I think it's important that we focus back on the crime that was committed by Mr. Miles just before Christmas in 1992. The Illinois Supreme Court summarized in one paragraph Mr. Miles' participation in this crime. And this comes from the Arizona Supreme Court's decision upholding his conviction and sentence. Miles participated extensively in the kidnapping and abduction. He went to get the gun, drove in the car, held the gun during the drive to the desert, and stood nearby while Jackson shot him, talking about Sparrow. During a 25 to 30 minute drive, Miles described the victim as, quote, scared to death, unquote. At the scene of the murder, Miles said he heard her cry and plead for her life. According to Miles, quote, she said, I'll do anything you want, don't hurt me. And she said that a few times. It was just like she kept saying it over and over, unquote. Miles saw the victim drop to her knees as Jackson shot her. All of this was reasonably foreseeable. We agree with the trial court that the murder was especially cruel. This, of course, after these three individuals, Mr. Miles, Jackson, and Hernandez, were searching for a victim. And Ms. Bowerman had the unfortunate circumstance of pulling out of the driveway, pausing for traffic, and having Mr. Jackson go up to the car and point a gun at her, tell her to move over when Miles and Hernandez got in the car and they drove out to the desert. One of the things that I'm sure is painful for the family to hear, but so this was December of 1992, one of the things that Mr. Miles did, there were Christmas presents that Ms. Bowerman had purchased for the family members that were in the car. Mr. Miles eventually sold all those in the Phoenix area. That was the Arizona Supreme Court's recitation of the facts of the case in terms of Mr. Miles' participation. The trial judge himself wrote a very lengthy sentencing memorandum. And if the board has had an opportunity to read all that, I'm not going to read all 14 pages, but if I could read a short passage that Judge Tindy, in passing sentence on Mr. Miles, found to be the facts of the case as Judge Tindy heard them as the trial unfolded in his courtroom. Judge Tindy wrote, the court finds that while the defendant did hold the murder weapon in his hand with his finger on the trigger during the transport of Ms. Bowerland, the court is not convinced that the defendant was the trigger man who fired the fatal shot at Ms. Bowerland. And I should say as an aside, we're not asserting that Mr. Miles did in fact pull the trigger. The state's position at the trial was that at all times that Mr. Jackson was the shooter, and I still believe that today. But Judge Tenney did find from the evidence that Mr. Miles had held a gun with his finger on the trigger during the transport. The court finds beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was a major active participant in every element of the planning and execution of the planned kidnapping and armed robbery. The defendant was a major player in the theft of the gun, the transport of Ms. Bowerman, the emotional torture of Ms. Bowerman, and the taking by force of Ms. Bowerman's car and personal property. It was the defendant who, after the murder, fled to another city, used Ms. Bowerman's credit card to obtain money from the bank, exchanged Ms. Bowerman's children's Christmas presents for other goods, fled with Ms. Bowerman's car, and finally fled by foot from the hot pursuit of a Phoenix policeman. The defendant was seriously involved in this senseless series of events from start to finish in a very major way. The defendant was not a minor participant in this series of events. The defendant tells a series of lies in his confession. In the defendant's first story to law enforcement officers, the defendant claimed he was not in Tucson on the day of the slaying, but had merely obtained the car after an unknown person had left it and ran. In a later story, the defendant said that a juvenile told him that he was just going to take her shoes and make her walk barefoot, and then he thought about it. He said no, he changed his mind, stripped her naked, and shot her. That she was about to have a heart attack, and that he, the defendant, was not there in Tucson. This report of the plan was just something he had been told. And this was the second version that Mr. Miles had told police when he was apprehended in Phoenix. When asked point blank by the officer, did you witness the shooting, the defendant answered, just as point blank, no, sir. Judge Tindy was on to write, finally, that in his last story, after admitting he was in Tucson at the death scene, the defendant said, we all walked to go get it, the gun. He, the juvenile, said he wanted to get some money. He was going to do something with the gun, something illegal with the gun. Before we even got in the car, he said he was going to take him off in the middle of the desert and shoot. The defendant, in all confession versions of his story, succeeds in keeping himself out of the active roles in these crimes until cornered by logic, and then admits the more active role until he finally describes the murder that puts the gun in the hand of another. The defendant was actively involved in every element of the kidnapping robbery, was physically present during the entire sequence of criminal activity culminating in the murder of Ms. Bowerman. He participated fully in the plan. He was fully aware of the victim's pleas for mercy while he held the loaded pistol during her transport. He could have terminated the incident by holding the gun, but he did not. Those were the words that Judge Tindy wrote before he sentenced Mr. Miles to death in 1993. There was a comment earlier about Mr. Miles and his disciplinary action and having not had any disciplinary actions for quite some time, and certainly I recognize that is true. I think the board understands also that Mr. Miles has been on death row since 1993. I think Mr. Gabrielson noted in pretty much isolation 23 hours a day, and so his disciplinary action is short. I would suggest that in the brief time that he's been in general population now, perhaps he has something to prove. Perhaps he has something to prove that it's not an anomaly that he has a short disciplinary list. And maybe he can prove over the next year or so that would remain to be true. That I think might be of some significance to the board rather than having a lack of disciplinary action while being isolated on death row. this crime was shockingly evil. Three young men, the oldest being the adult, Mr. Miles, randomly selected an innocent person who was simply sitting in their car waiting to move into traffic. They had no knowledge of her, no knowledge of who she was. They'd never met her before. This was a random kidnapping and murder. They had already stolen a gun, as Mr. Miles has admitted, and Judge Tenney found that Mr. Miles was significantly involved in the theft of that gun, and then they went looking for a victim. This at a time, as I've already said, that Mr. Miles had already picked out three previous victims and committed armed robbery of them starting in early November and then continuing in the weeks prior to the murder in early December. So Mr. Miles was no stranger at that time to committing violence upon another person using a weapon to take their property. The day that Ms. Fowler was killed, Mr. Miles participated in stealing the weapon. They went looking for a victim, and they found an innocent victim in the person of Patricia Bowden. They drove her out to the desert and shot her. Took her belongings, and Mr. Miles took the car, most of the property, and fled to Phoenix. I recognize that at some point that Mr. Miles is going to be paroled to a consecutive sentence, and I know that 35 years, of which back in 1992, I believe he'd be eligible after two-thirds of his sentence, but he's going to serve a considerable amount of time when and if this board paroles him from his life sentence. I would ask the board to deny parole at this point in time, and let's see what kind of person Mr. Miles can be in prison over the next year or 2 years. Is he the person that is being portrayed now as someone who can avoid criminal actions? We don't really have a good feel for that, I would submit to you, given his isolation for the past 20-some years. I would ask the board to deny parole at this point, wait and see what kind of inmate Mr. Miles can prove himself to be over the next year, and revisit the matter at that point. As I said, while I know he's not going to be getting out, the belief of my office is that Mr. Miles was one of the prime reasons that this murder took place. He'd shown the propensity in the weeks before to commit other crimes, to victimize other people, and we believe that that parole at this point should be denied.
Okay, any questions? Okay, Ms. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're coming up on a conclusion about this hearing right now. Mr. Gregson, I'm going to see Mr. Miles.
Yes, sir.
So I'm going to give, we're coming up on a conclusion of the hearing, so I'm going to give you the opportunity to present any last minute information or anything else that you'd like to present to the board. Would you like to do that, or would you like to have your attorney do it, or both?
Well, I would like to say that I disagree with the prosecutor in the sense of how easy it is. I may be paraphrasing what he's saying, but how easy it is for someone to have a good disciplinary record in isolation. When you're in isolation for 23 hours a day, you have nothing, but you don't have anything to do but to think about why you're in isolation. You're around other people who are facing the death penalty, their hopelessness, their anger, their disgust, just who they are and who they are as human beings. It's really difficult to maintain your composure. You have many rules and regulations. Obviously, you're in prison. It's not summer camp. I understand that. Okay. But you have many rules and regulations that obviously don't have anything to do with the safe and secure movement of the prison. But you're under all, you're just, we call them thumb rules, just to keep them under your thumb. And like I said, once again, you're in prison. You're supposed to be in prison. You did something wrong, as I've admitted to. Whether it took me a minute to admit it to the police when I first got arrested, I understand that. And once again, that's my bad, that's my fault. But now, these 26 years that I have been, or 25 years that I have been in isolation, you're dealing with 10 to 12 other personalities you can get disciplinary infractions for not having your towel hanging in the right spot. You can get disciplinary infractions for not having your TV in the right spot, not being fully dressed at 6 o'clock in the morning. I've avoided all these things. I've become a model prisoner, so whether I stay in isolation or the most open yard, who I was in isolation is going to be who I am in a more lax prison, a more lower custody level prison, or one day even on the street. I had the ability, well, I had the chance to be diagnosed by top-notch physicians and top-notch psychologists, even though I didn't have the chance to participate in rehabilitatory programs within a prison. The fact that I've been diagnosed by all these doctors has taught me who I am and who I need to become to be a productive member, not just of prison society, but if one day I should happen to be a member of real society, I know who I am, what my triggers are, who not to be around, who to hang around, and what not to put in my body. And that's all I have to say. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Gibbs, I want to give you a few minutes to kind of put in some last-minute comments, and then the board is going to go into discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, and I thank the board for all the courtesies they have said to me this morning. Mr. Unglesby talked about the three prior robberies. Judge Villarreal found that those robberies are also mitigated by the ARND and the cocaine withdrawal syndrome, that he wouldn't have been out doing those if it weren't for the cocaine withdrawal syndrome. Mr. Unglesby also read extensively from the sentencing memorandum of the trial judge and from the Arizona Supreme Court. Judge Villarreal makes this point repeatedly in Appendix A, the order we submitted from Judge Villarreal, that those courts didn't have the information in front of them that he had to make his ruling based on. They had no idea about Kevin's social history. They didn't know that his mother, biological mother, was a drug addict and a prostitute. They didn't know that Kevin's adoptive mother was an alcoholic and a prostitute. Mr. Unglesby suggests that we wait another year before Kevin come before the board again. There's not much more Kevin can do in the writing room and writing, but also in the Department of Corrections to prove his worthiness for this board to commute into his 35-year sentences. One point that hasn't been made, but which is important, is that Kevin lives in an interracial housing unit. It's a program that was set up by the DOC. They take volunteers. These are guys that want to live with members of other races. Kevin lives with a Caucasian, a white inmate who has also done 26 years in prison in the Department of Corrections without incident. These two older inmates are great role models to the young guys that have other ideas about gang membership and contraband and some other things. Kevin's a great example. And I think I would close with this, that if Mr. Johnson made this point earlier, if Kevin doesn't have any infractions in the last 18 years, and Mr. Unglesby made the point, well, he's locked down. I couldn't speak more eloquently than Kevin did to the fact that my guys get written up for putting their towels on the wrong rack, for having their TV, as Kevin said, the wrong place. And you'll see, if you haven't seen them, you're going to see the disciplinary records for inmates that are, you know, locked down 23 hours a day and still have lengthy lists of infractions that they commit. And finally, I'll close with this. The point that hasn't been made is that Kevin served 22 years on death row. There's literature out there, if the board hasn't seen it, there's a developing body of psychological literature on something called death row syndrome. It's the unique psychological pain and distress that's caused to people that are really in a lockdown situation for 23 hours a day, who are constantly thinking about the fact that at some point the state of Arizona is going to come and stick a needle in my arm and kill me. And in 2015, one of the U.S. Supreme Court justices in a death penalty case from Oklahoma was talking about death row syndrome and said that that these unique psychological intrusions are to inmates who have had decades of especially severe dehumanizing conditions of confinement. These guys, Kevin lived with us for 22 years, the prospect that the state of Arizona would kill him. And until Judge Villarreal issued his order in December of 2015, Kevin went 22 years, but the only belief in his mind was that all his appeals had failed and that at some point they were going to be coming to get him in order to execute him. Death row syndrome, it's starting, we talked about in the psychiatric and psychological literature, it's as I said, an especially severe psychological deprivation that the guy suffered while on death row. Kevin, because of, not because of the programs, as we talked about, because of his good character and his ability to now see the big picture, understands that the path he chose early in life was the wrong path. And I think given this opportunity, if he's paroled down to his 35 years, this court will never see him come back with disciplinary infractions on his record, even 20 years from now, if he comes back asking to be paroled out. And also the message this court would send by granting Kevin parole to his consecutives would send a message to other inmates in the DOC who have been a long time that good behavior and making effective use of rehabilitative programs is something that's to be pursued because it might get you some light at the end of the tunnel. Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you. Okay, the board's going to go into discussion now. Mr. Miles?
Yes, sir.
The board's going to go into discussion. So now the board's in discussion. We will make a determination whether to parole you to your next consecutive sentence, absolute discharge, or deny parole to your next consecutive sentence, sir. I'm going to ask you to remain on the phone so you can hear the conversation taking place between the board when we've completed and made our decision. I will get right back to you, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. The board is now going into discussion. We've had the opportunity to review the file and go over the information. We've also had the opportunity to hear from the witnesses, Danny, and as well as Mr. Gableson, the attorney for Mr. Miles, and we also heard from Mr. Huckabee on it, representing. We've heard quite a bit of information. I think that in reviewing the file, there were several appeals that were heard. He was sentenced to the actual death sentence. There has been a lot of information presented or spoken to, referenced the cocaine withdrawal, the problem with the mother being an alcoholic and at the time that he was born and some of the hijacking of the brain chemistry that actually was caused, which led to the judge reversing the sentence from a death sentence to a 25 years of life sentence. However, in reviewing it today, there's a couple of things that are of concern to me. The first one is that Mr. Miles was on drugs, continued to use drugs at least for a period of time. He was put on death row in 1993, and he says that he last used drugs, which is in 1997, in which he did have the accessibility. I would think that being on death row and locked down for 23 hours a day makes it a little bit more difficult to have the ability to obtain drugs. It looks like, I think, according to his pre-sentence, the pre-sentence report that we got, as well as the age report, I think he was taken off the death row in 2018. I think when he was actually taken off the death row, that he has been taking some programs. It did appear, I thought, that there was one program, I don't know exactly what it was, that had to do with substance abuse that he had taken. It was a class, and I don't know what it is, it's just a substance 827, but it may not have been a substance abuse class, I don't know, but talking to both Mr. Gableson and Mr. Miles, the issues that led to him not being able to make a decision was still there. He has not received any treatments for it. And according to Mr. Miles, when I asked him, had he taken any drug rehabilitation programs as of this time, he still stated that he hadn't taken any pharma classes in drug rehabilitation, that he was on a list to get into AA programs at the current facility that he's actually in at this time. Mr. Miles has expressed some remorse. He did that right at the beginning when he began to speak
There is the untreated condition, and according to Ms. Gregor, and listening to her, that she's known him for some time here. She was there when they lived in the same apartment complex and wind up getting evicted, and the wife and the kid going to one location. He stayed with her for a period of time, and subsequently later came to visit her when she moved out of state. During this time, the period of time, and she said that she was known that there had been some use of alcohol and cocaine during that period of time that they were also together, but he appeared to be a good guy, a normal guy, and not have any problems with the exception of that. I at this point right now, do not feel comfortable with granting Mr. Miles an actual discharge of parole to his next consecutive sentence. Because of those reasons, there's been no substance abuse passes as taken. I do take note that he did have an extended period of no disciplinary action, but he was on death row for the minority of that majority of that time, and not involved in a regular population, that there's still an untreated condition that has not been treated. So I do have those concerns. Those are my opinion, but I'm willing to listen to the rest of my colleagues at this time. Ms. Rittenhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I tend to agree with you. There are many factors to consider in this case, and certainly Mr. Miles's behavior is definitely on the right track, and we hope that will continue. He speaks very well, which is a good thing. He speaks well for himself. But what is very compelling to me is the testimony of the victims, and I cannot, based on that, I cannot support parole at this time.
Okay. Any more comments? Mr. Kenyon?
I just want to thank my colleagues for giving such a good summary. I don't think it's necessary to belabor the deliberation. I will say, in general, I do find that a life sentence at this point is appropriate. I would not support parole to his next consecutive sentence. Thank you.
Okay.
I agree.
Send no other comments. My friend, did you have anything to agree? Send no other comments coming from the board, then I am going to make a motion to deny Mr. Whitnall's absolute discharge of parole to his next consecutive sentence. This incident occurred in 1992, therefore I am also going to ask for a one-year set-off.
Second.
Agreed.
Agreed.
Motion by myself. Second, Ms. Rittenhouse. Agree, Dr. Wright. Agree, Mr. Neal. Agree, Mr. Quinones.
Mr. Johnson, can you explain for me, I may be a novice, if this was a one-year set-off?
Sir?
The one-year, you said, mentioned a one-year set-off?
For prior to, since that occurred in 1984, then they were eligible to come up for parole every 6 months, but then after 1984, legislators passed the law that allowed for the board to ask for a one-year set-off. And so the one-year set-off means that it would be 1 year before he can come back before this board.
From this day, for turning down on this parole.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you, sir, for clarifying.
The reasons for denial was going to be that it was a serious and violent offense, a loss of human life. I'm going to mark it as a serious and deviant offense because of taking the victim out to the desert and I'm going to also mark that, you know, because of the prior criminal history, because there were some history of robbery prior to this incident occurred, history of continued substance abuse. Okay. He has had some programmers. I'm not going to mark lack of program, but I am going to mark a poor release plan. He just only had to just go stay with a friend and out of state, and which he, if he was paroled, he would have to be here and apply for a waiver to actually go out of state.
Mr. Johnson, I apologize for interrupting again. What I'm asking that he were paroled out, right? And so I'm not quite understanding why, whether a sponsor would accept it is either relevant, and if it were, she's not out of state. You mentioned she was out of state. She's not out of state.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is just go say we have the information that we have here, and he has a institutional progress report.
Yes, sir. He also went out that said he's got a friend in Washington State. Right. I just want to clarify, Ms. Pagel also said she would take him in. And she would
I understand, but what I am going by is what he actually have on here. So this release plan that we actually have here is not a good, you know, a release plan. It doesn't really say who the good friend is, where they would stay.
And first question, I apologize again. I don't understand what the relevance of a release plan is at this point. 20 years from now, yes, it could be relevant. I don't understand what it's relevant to now.
Well, what it's relevant to now, sir, is that actually when we actually look at a hearing and we go to mark off all of the incidents involving the hearing, and based on what he has in there, that we actually do look at, you know, what type of release plan that he has, because there's two things that's actually asked for in here. He's up for parole to his next consecutive sentence, or parole for an absolute discharge. And so we're denying him not only a parole to his next consecutive sentence, we are also denying him an absolute discharge, and those would be reasons to add on to for the absolute discharge, sir. I'm not going to mark. He doesn't, you know, no family support. I saw him, but he did have support from a friend that was actually here. So I'm not going to mark no family or community support, because he did have some community support that was actually here. That is going to conclude the remarks at this time. Mr. Miles?
Yes.
Okay, sir, the board is voted to deny you parole to your next consecutive sentence or an absolute discharge at this time, sir. We've also asked for a one-year set-off, which would mean that you would be eligible to come back before this board somewhere, you know, after 1 year from now. That would be determined by the Department of Corrections to schedule another hearing before this board. Sir, do you understand that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, did you hear the reasons for denial, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, did you understand them, or would you like for me to repeat them?
No, it's okay.
Okay. Sir, I do want to thank you for taking the time and opportunity for appearing before this board, sir. I also want to thank Mr. Gavison, and as well as all of the people who have come here, the victim witness side, for participating in this hearing today. That is going to conclude the hearing for Mr. Miles at this time, sir. Thank everyone for attendance, sir. Mr. Miles, could you please put the CO3 back on the line?
Yes, sir.